Welcome to the Media Madness Podcast, where we stop the madness by analyzing the news and critiquing the media. I'm Alex Nitzberg, and today my guest is Cliff Kincaid. Cliff is the director of the Ames Center for Investigative Journalism at Accuracy in Media, and he's also the president of America's Survival, Inc. He's authored or co-authored several books, including his latest book, co-authored with Clifford Kincaid and Dr. Tina Trent. It's titled Marxist Madrasas, The Hostile Takeover of Higher Education in America, How the Revolution in Online Learning Can Help Students Bypass the Cultural Marxist in Academia and Get Real Skills and Jobs. So it's good to have you back on the show today, Cliff. Thank you for joining me.
Great to be with you, Alex.
So first of all, can you explain to everyone, why did you title your book Marxist Madrasas?
I have to thank a friend of mine. We call him Jimmy from Brooklyn. He's an analyst of communist affairs from New York City, who I've known for years and years and years. He's got a keen intellect and comes up with these catchy slogans and titles, and he referred to colleges that way, and I said, Jimmy, that's great. I'm going to use that, and of course, I gave him credit for that. He also came up with the slogan, Separation of Marx and State, which is something I use on the back cover and as the title of a chapter, because what we're seeing here is how Marxism has infiltrated state-funded colleges and universities.
And can you explain also, a madrasa is an Islamic school, isn't it?
Yes. Madrasa is an Islamic school that indoctrinates the students in the Quran. And so what I'm trying to suggest here is that many of our colleges and universities have become indoctrination centers, but not in the Quran, not in Islam, but in Marxism.
Yeah, and I have written down here in my notes that many universities in America are indoctrination centers, just like what you said, where students are inculcated with liberalism and inoculated against biblical morality and conservative ideas. And in your book, you warned about the propagation of cultural Marxism on college campuses. On page 69, you say, quote, "One warning that a particular college or university is in the grip of cultural Marxism is the emphasis on diversity." And then on page 70, you also say, and this is another quote, "In a real sense, cultural Marxism is diversity. This is not intellectual diversity, but diversity that obliterates traditional and biblical moral standards and requires acceptance of behavior and actions that used to be considered perversions. It is a pleasant-sounding notion that is deliberately designed to blind us to the damaging impact it has in real life on people and institutions." So, Cliff, can you explain, you know, what cultural Marxism is and how it is destroying the higher educational system?
Well, that is a big part of our book, Alex. Cultural Marxism is a new development in Marxism. Normally, we think of Marxism as an economic theory, as the revolt of the working class to get their economic rights and control over their destiny. But what the Marxists in modern-day times have done is translated that into cultural affairs, meaning essentially that sexual minorities, and they keep coming up with new ones, but normally LGBTQ, now they've added various categories, are part of the oppressed classes, are part of those who are being oppressed by the white power structure, and therefore they are in revolt. They have special rights that have to be protected. And this is what they mean, quote, by diversity. They don't mean diversity of thought. They don't mean giving any kind of recognition to those who believe in conservative values. This is all about sexual minorities. And this is what we've seen when diversity is practiced on various college campuses. We see queer studies departments, gender studies. You can go down the list. But these are all considered or recognized by the cultural Marxists as sexual minority groups that, of course, have been oppressed by the white power structure and the heterosexual ethic, as they call it. So this is where it's all gone, and this is really an epidemic on college campuses, especially at state schools, and even at Catholic colleges. I've got a section in the book at what's happening at Georgetown, which is the oldest Catholic Jesuit university in the United States, where even though a Catholic teaching says that homosexual behavior is intrinsically disordered and immoral, Georgetown, at the end of an academic year, has a special lavender graduation ceremony for the so-called LGBTQ students. So this is all across the country, in Catholic and non-Catholic schools alike, and even and mostly at state-funded colleges and universities.
And this issue of a gender revolution on college campuses is also something I've been covering, and I had a couple of articles, but one of them I linked to the Campus Pride Index, and it has a list of 244 institutions, like colleges and places, that are LGBTQ friendly on various levels. They rank them on like a scale of how many stars of LGBTQ friendliness. And then I just did some investigating, and I found approximately 64, I think it was 64 more colleges that were not on that list. So when you add that together, that's over 300 colleges that are promoting this sexual revolution, this redefining gender. They call it like a gender spectrum sometimes, because it's, you know, so many different options. But, you know, some of the ideas that are related to cultural Marxism are the ideas of deconstruction and critical theory. And you talk about critical theory in your book. And here's a quote. You said, "It's a sophisticated attack dressed in academic jargon on the foundations of Western society in order to destroy the culture. An offshoot was critical race theory." And then you say, as Dr. Tina Trent has pointed out, Marxist Haywood Burns, a Harvard honors graduate and Yale-educated lawyer, and this is a quote, I guess, from Tina Trent, it says, was an early and influential proponent of critical race theory, which asserts that the American legal system is essentially an instrument for perpetuating white supremacy and black oppression, end quote. Now, that sounds exactly like the ideology of Black Lives Matters movement and the ideology that's promoted on many college campuses today. So can you explain critical theory and deconstruction and how that's impacted America's universities?
These two are big topics that we cover extensively in the book. I don't want to go into detail about them, but essentially what we're looking at is unrelenting criticism of the United States and the Judeo-Christian foundations of our country. And it's taken the form of undermining everything, all the traditional values that most people hold dear. And it's a critique from a Marxist perspective. That's what critical theory is and critical race theory is. Along the lines that whites are the oppressors. Now, this is a theme I keep coming back to, but this is what they talk about unrelentingly. They keep insisting that whites are oppressors, whites have to be challenged, the white power structure has to be overthrown. And of course, the key point that we make in that context is that both Barack and Michelle Obama went through classes on critical race theory. And moreover, we have a whole section on Hillary Clinton, the failed Democratic nominee for president, having gone to Wellesley College initially as a young Republican, as a Goldwater girl, and coming out as a Marxist. In fact, a disciple of Saul Alinsky, the so-called community organizer, whose tactics were taught to Barack Obama when he was a community organizer in Chicago. So these theories are not just pie in the sky, but they are practical, and they are being taught to students, students who go through these Ivy League colleges and others and assume positions of power in the United States, such as Barack Obama, who implemented them as president. And we can see, in my view, the divisions, not only in the emergence of Black Lives Matter, but in the assassinations of police officers around the country. A few recent killings occurred over the last few days.
You know, and you mentioned diversity as being something that sounds nice, but in actuality, it's promoting something different. And then you also said in your book that world government is currently being promoted on college and university campuses through peace studies or peace and justice studies. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, these are other areas of concern that we talk about in the book, and I can go into those. You know, what's amazing to me, Alex, though, in writing this book with the help of my oldest son and Dr. Tina Trent, is coming upon the fact that these are indeed Marxist madrasas. And that is, as we hinted at earlier or alluded to earlier, these students are going through these colleges and being taught these concepts like diversity, but they really don't know what diversity really is. They don't understand diversity of thought, and they don't want to be exposed to any ideas that undermine their developing Marxist worldview. And to cite an example of that, that I think we basically predict in part of our book, we've seen in the reaction to the Donald J. Trump victory on November 8th, many colleges and universities treating their students as people who need counseling, as people who are in shock at the fact that the American people themselves would vote for a Republican for president. These cases, these instances are too numerous to mention here. But of course, as I point out in the book, the whole thrust or the whole impetus for actually writing this book in the first place was the fact that I personally had been disinvited from a college campus, the State University of SUNY New Paltz, because of my views, because of my conservative views. I was actually part of a campus debate between left and right that had gotten canceled. Now, later, because of the embarrassment caused to the college and administration, I got reinvited. But this was astounding to me. I had heard about conservatives being disinvited, but a conservative being disinvited, even though he was part of a debate format. And so this is what we're seeing on the college campuses, not only the dangers in many students assuming or coming to embrace Marxist worldviews, but they have no time and they feel even offended or threatened by opposing conservative views. This is the beginnings of a totalitarian movement that I think we've seen in the wake of the Trump victory, where these students just don't want to, not only do they not want to hear these opposing views, they want to stamp them out.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you to talk about that too, that experience you had at the State University of New York. But, you know, I talked to Colonel West a while ago on the podcast, and it happens to him too. He had I was talking about one specific incident, but I think it's happened more than once where students will stage a walkout or somehow they'll protest him speaking on a college campus. So it's been happening to, you know, several. It happens to conservative speakers. But so you were on an airplane, correct? And you got a call while you're getting ready to fly to your debate, and they told you that you were no longer invited.
That's right. I was on the tarmac at Reagan National Airport about ready to fly up to Albany and then to go to SUNY New Paltz. And I was told by the Speaker's Bureau to get off the plane, get my bags, and go home because some faculty member up there, and we have her name, some faculty member had Googled my name. And because Google is so left-leaning, when you Google my name, Cliff Kincaid, the first thing that comes up is a derogatory entry from the Southern Poverty Law Center about how I'm supposed to be an extreme right winger. And in fact, I've been selected as one of 30 members of the so-called radical right. And then the Council on American Islamic Relations picked me up and put me on their list of leading Islamophobes. This kind of junk is highlighted by Google, and the faculty member simply Googled my name, didn't bother to call me, didn't bother to ask me anything, and she raised a stink with other faculty members, and that led to the initial cancellation. Again, this is, and I should make the point that in this case, it wasn't the students who objected to me. In fact, everything we know about the incident suggests the students wanted to see the debate. I mean, after all, it was a debate, you know, left and right, liberal and conservative. It was the faculty members. So this is what's happening behind the scenes on many college campuses. Some of these are outward or open incidents of suppression and totalitarianism. And we've seen more of it in the wake of the Donald J. Trump victory. And I think even some mainstream liberal professors are getting very concerned about this, that we're producing students, producing graduates who just can't handle the idea of opposing views.
And I know what you're talking about with the Southern Poverty Law Center thing, because I think I Googled you before. In fact, I think I Googled you yesterday, and it wasn't the first thing there, but when I Googled you one time in the past, I found that the Southern Poverty Law Center is not fond of you. So,
well, this is a group that exists, and by the way, we have quite a few pages in our book on the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is a group that makes money by smearing conservatives, and they actually have a reserve fund, or you might call it an endowment, of $300 million. They raise that money by sounding the alarm about conservatives like me. Now, you know, I have no association with any extremist groups. I'm a mainstream conservative writer and thinker. I came through Stan Evans National Journalism Center program back in 1978 and then got hired by AIM. I have a degree in journalism. You know, I'm a journalist, I'm an analyst, I'm an investigator. But they lump me in with supposed extremists and other people that I've never heard of, never met, as a member of the, quote, radical right. And I turn the tables on them, Alex, because I point out that the Southern Poverty Law Center participated earlier this year in a so-called New Left or Left Forum conference in New York City, which featured a number of Marxist, communist, and pro-Arab Muslim extremist groups. And so they're the ones who are tied to the extremists, not me.
And so your book, you talk about what you think the solution to this problem of this the Marxist culture on colleges, and you think that using more online programs will help with that. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, this is really, I think, one of the most important parts of the book, written by my oldest son, Clifford, who has taken advantage of these online courses and has, in fact, obtained a master's degree using them. And it's a good case study because my oldest son graduated with a psychology degree and in an education that cost about $100,000, but he couldn't find a job. He couldn't get a job. He was eventually working at a grocery store, then finally selling some phones. But of course, that's not what he wanted to do. And he eventually went to South Korea, where he's now teaching English to Korean students at a university. He's got a great job. He really enjoys it. He's found his calling. But he's the one who informed me about this option of online learning. And this is a way, and we go into it in some detail, especially in his chapter, of students avoiding the costs associated with the brick-and-mortar universities and being able to avoid all this political correctness on campus, being able to take classes they enjoy, they want to take at their own convenience and, as I say, at lesser cost, and getting the education they want that will produce a marketable skill and a good job. And I'm convinced this is the way we have to go, because I know there are groups out there who think that we can put pressure on these liberal colleges and universities, maybe get them to add some solid courses. But I have concluded that these brick-and-mortar colleges just cannot be changed. They're so huge. They're big bureaucratic institutions. They spend so much money on diversity and gender studies and all the rest of it, LGBTQ, on and on it goes, that the only way to diminish their importance in society is to pursue this online revolution in learning and education. And by comparison, I point out that we've had that kind of revolution in journalism. where today we have all kinds of online journalistic options for people. We have made it easier for people to get news and information, even to start their own websites, their own blogs. They can start their own TV channels, even. And yet that same kind of revolution in journalism hasn't been matched in academia. Now, there are some colleges and universities who are offering online courses. And I should warn people, there are some ripoffs in that field. And you have to be careful about what you buy and where you go to find your particular field of study or courses. Many of them are reputable, and students can save lots of money and get a good education that way. And I think by doing so, we can undermine the very foundation of the Marxist madrasas I complain about in the book.
And so a couple of specific questions about that. If students are taking online classes, do you think that, like, why would being online necessarily protect them from the Marxism? Because couldn't the teacher still try to indoctrinate them, you know, from afar? And then the second question is, do you still believe that it would be important for people to study liberal arts, or do you think they should focus more on specific skills, like, you know, a specific area?
In regard to the first question, it's possible that, yeah, you could still get some kind of biased Marxist or liberal professor, but you have to do your diligence. You have to investigate in advance and check these professors. I know a lot of students go to that site, Rate Your Professor, or Rate My Professor, whatever it's called. But I think this is a way that students can concentrate on practical or marketable skills. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't disregard other liberal arts fields of study. Just be careful that you don't, for example, make philosophy or gender studies into your preoccupation or your main field of study. And by way of contrast or explanation, I point out in the book that I was a philosophy major for 2.5 years, and I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed philosophy, studying the whether God exists, the mind-body problem, the problem of evil, all these mammoth questions. And I did very well in it, actually. I was probably getting about a 3.5 in philosophy. But then finally, after 2.5 years, I went to the department chairman. I said, what can I do with a philosophy major? And he said, well, you can get a PhD or you can drive a taxi. And, of course, getting a PhD might qualify me to teach in philosophy, which is what he suggested. But, of course, those jobs are few and far between, and I didn't really want to drive a taxi, or maybe in today's terms, an Uber. But so I actually, in my own case, Alex, dropped out of college at that point for about a year. I pumped fuel at a truck stop. I thought about my future. And that's when I went back to college, this time at the University of Toledo, Ohio, and concentrated or majored in journalism and communications, and came to D.C., as I said earlier, in the summer of 78, and the rest is history. So it's fine to take a philosophy course or even gender studies if you find that interesting, but just put it into context that there are not that many jobs. And, you know, this is, we also deal with this in the book, the fact that our colleges and universities and their administrations aren't telling students the truth about the lack of jobs in these fields. And so, consequently, that's why we have so many students graduating with 50, 100, or even more hundreds of thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars in debt, and they're showing up to Bernie Sanders rallies because they want the federal government to bail them out. And this is an area that I'm going to spend a lot more time in the future on, because we are going to have a new administration, and it's not going to be good enough just to help students repay their debt in a different way or lower the interest rates. We've got to do something about the whole of academia and the fact that so much Marxism has been incorporated into the system. So, You know, I'm just to give you one more concrete example that I came upon since the book was published, we found out that the University of Texas at Austin had committed $250,000, $250,000, to a Black Studies conference featuring communist Angela Davis as the keynote speaker. And apparently Davis charged $10,000 to speak, first class airfare, blah, but the total cost, $250,000. Now, whose purposes are really served by that? You know, to bring in a communist, this was not a balanced debate, a balanced presentation, but this is what's being done across the United States. Davis, in fact, is a popular speaker on many college campuses, even though she's a former top communist, a winner of the Lenin Peace Prize, and she's being presented as a Black spokesman on college campuses. You know, whose purposes are being served by that? So these are the things that are happening that we continue to expose, but at the same time, we tell students, you know, use your heads. And in my case, follow perhaps your father's advice. My dad always told me, Alex, get a marketable skill. Like I say, it took 2.5 years for me to wake up about what that really meant. But fortunately, it turned out good in my case. I've enjoyed being a journalist and a media critic. But too many students are going through 4 years or more coming out with big debt and no future.
All right, Clifton, before we go, where can people go to get your book?
Well, the best place to go is Amazon.com. Just put in Marxist Madrasas by Cliff Kincaid. That's probably the best way to go. Go to Amazon.com because we did publish through a subsidiary called CreateSpace, and it's only about $10.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me today, Cliff. It's been great to have you back on the show.
Been great to be with you, Alex.
All right, and thank you all for listening to the Media Madness podcast, where we stop the madness by analyzing the news and critiquing the media. I'm Alex Nitzberg, and I hope you'll join me for the next episode of the Media Madness podcast.